Europe on Air.
Europe on Air.
Europa por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour program looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday 4:30 to 5 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Europe on Air. I'm Alan Bradish and this week we will be discussing World War One and the Irish situation. We're joined in studio today by Cathal Brennan, presenter of Near FM's Irish History Show, and Padraig Yates, journalist and author, whose books include A City in Wartime, Dublin, 1914 to 1918. You're both very welcome.
Thanks, Alan.
We might start off, Cathal, with yourself. Could you take us through perhaps the principal events which led to the start of the First World War?
Oh, that's a hard thing to sum up. There's so many different interpretations of what led to the First World War and all the different factors involved. Like, depending on different historians, they could point to a whole range of factors. And it was probably all of the above, really. Like, even things that would seem as obscure as, like, the Berlin to Baghdad railway. But you have other things like, you know, imperialism, the growth of imperialism throughout Africa, regional disputes, particularly within around the Balkans with Austria-Hungary. You're coming to this period where you had these large multi-ethnic kingdoms in Europe that were just simply too unwieldy. You had nationalities within them, ethnic groups, national groups, religious groups that were seeking self-determination. There was economic factors, there was military alliances. There was so many different issues like... really, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, it's the trigger. It's not the cause, because there's so many different causes. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been that, it probably would have been something else later down the line.
So it's fair to say that the regimes in power at the time, or the power structures in place in Europe, were ready for war, or were ready to disintegrate into war. And the assassination of the Archduke was just merely one factor that led to that. Perhaps we might pass over to you, Padraig. What was the situation in Ireland at the time of the outbreak of the war?
The situation in Ireland was very fraught. There was imminent expectation of civil war between North and South. The Curragh mutiny meant that there were elements in the British Army who were aligned really with the Tory party, which was aligned with Edward Carson and the Unionists, who had sworn to fight. Many of them had signed the Ulster Covenant, some of them in their own blood, to resist Home Rule. So I think one of the calculations that the Germans made, and I think it's generally accepted now, was the situation in Ireland, plus all the industrial unrest in Britain and the suffragette campaign and so on, meant that they thought the British would not intervene if they took a shortcut through Belgium to carry out the Slieffen plan, their sort of master military plan. But I think a more fundamental problem for all of the governments, and it's not unlike today, is that Europe, not just Britain or Ireland, had developed economically and socially through the previous century. But the political elites were still using the international relations that had been developed at the Congress of Vienna in 1815. So you had a diplomatic political elite who were trying to do things the way they did in the days of horses and carriages, and it wasn't working. And I think while it's dangerous, obviously, to emphasise the personal too much, it is important. And we had the unfortunate situation where the two key players, if you like, the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, and Tsar Nicholas II, were not up to the job. They didn't have the judgment or the capacity or the knowledge to make informed decisions. Whatever the shortcomings of French or British or even the Austro-Hungarian Emperor, the two of the key players who actually plunged the continent into war were very mediocre figures who, by accident, had been put at the top of a system. But I think any time you look at any major catastrophe historically, it's a breakdown of the system, It's not people rising up to change things. It's incapacity to keep things under control at the top that trigger all these things. And in Ireland, the situation was really dictated by outside forces, I think, at that stage. Up until the war began, it was internal dynamics primarily, overseen by the British government. But once the war began, the Irish project, if you like, the Home Rule project, went on the back burner. One of the very first things the government did after war was declared was suspend the Third Home Rule Bill, which did in the short term defuse the situation. But it was a very fraught situation in Ireland in July, August 14.
Now, we've mentioned the Easter Rising, and I'll ask this question to both of you. Maybe you, Cathal. What impact did the Easter Rising, when it occurred, have on the war, and both initially and following the suppression of the Rising?
Well, there'd been a lot of developments in the time before after the war starts, the First World War starts, and by the time you get to the Easter Rising. So the popularity of the war is starting to wane at that stage. Redmond had really sort of like almost a poker term, he'd gone all in on the war. And if the war had been short, it probably would have been a great triumph for him politically as he had backed it to the hilt. But he was probably the most committed. Well, he was the most committed among the Irish Parliamentary Party for the war. But at that stage, you're starting to see recruitment slow. The people who would have been most enthusiastic for the war would have been the people who would have signed up at this in the first couple of months. So even in Britain, they're bringing in conscription at that stage. And it's being extended out to, you know, married men and then men into their 40s. But in Ireland, it depends really on what your politics are. And it develops over the space of the week. And as the executions take place, there is even among people who have opposed the Rising, a grudging respect for the fact that they held out for a week, that there's anger that the men were executed. It's hard to say, would that have happened without the war? Probably not, because the war probably prevented a civil war in Ireland. Like, how big a deal it was in Britain. Like, you had the two largest parties in Britain almost at odds over this. You had the Tories, supposedly the loyal opposition, are backing armed forces who are threatening to take up arms against the Parliament and the King. You know, it's a very fragile times in terms of the peace. And as Porrick said, it's probably one of the factors that led Germany to believe that Britain wouldn't come in to defend Belgian neutrality.
As Cathal said there, the sympathy that flowed towards the executed leaders of the Easter Rising would obviously have been a factor in Ireland. How strong, though, was the threat or the worry of conscription, which of course had been a strong factor in the volunteers seeking to arm themselves? How strong a factor did that remain after the Rising?
Well, it increased after the Rising, as Cathal says. The British government were desperately extending the cohorts, the age cohorts that they were recruiting from. By 1918, they were looking at teenagers. And I think it's generally accepted now that one of the reasons they threatened conscription in 1918 was not so much they expected to get many troops out of Ireland, but because somehow they had to tell British mothers, we're going to send your 18-year-old to fight in France. And they had to be seen to be doing everything possible to get troops. And the obvious place to go was Ireland. And yes, I mean, after the Rising, it did transform the situation, or at least it accelerated a process. But the war had been gnawing away. It was never Ireland's war to the same extent. It was a British war, and the British government never succeeded in selling the war as our war in this country to other than a small unionist minority. And I say a small unionist minority, I mean the southern unionist upper class, maybe northern unionist upper class, some working class communities in Belfast and so on. But for a lot of Irish people, nothing to do with us. We don't want it. And every hardship, fuel shortages, food shortages, railways being taken over for military purposes, and commercial traffic and commuter traffic being downgraded. Every hardship that occurred, businesses having to close early and because of the fuel shortages, all those sort of things, curfews, they were all because of the war. And people said, well, it's not our war. And the last thing they wanted was conscription. So, yes, from 1917 onwards, when the volunteers were reorganising, it became a key issue. And although it was an issue around which entire nationalist Ireland organised, the Irish Party were involved as well, and the Catholic Church were crucial, it was the volunteers who were the biggest single beneficiaries from it. And in fact, volunteer membership peaked in 1918. It didn't peak in 1921 or 22. It peaked when the threat of conscription was greatest.
And yet, of course, there were not only those members of the volunteers who had heeded Redmond's call to travel to Europe, but others who had volunteered over that period and were fighting in Europe. Did the fact that those men were fighting Europe have any impact beyond the impact it would have obviously had on their families? Were they visible at all to the greater public? I know you've said that it was not perceived as being our war, but was there any sense that that fight by Irish volunteers to the British Army, was there any sense, or were they visible in any way to the public at large in Ireland?
Certainly the Irish Times in particular, Loyalist, Unionist press in particular, emphasised the role of the British Army. There were pictures on the front pages displayed, big picture blocks on the front page of men who died. Usually gave the officers first, and then if there was room, you gave privates. Obviously, you had to have men with pictures. That would tend to, you know, mean more officers anyway. But that was a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you're saying these men died fighting in a good cause. On the other hand, you're saying it's not a very healthy or wise thing to do to go over there in the first place. And some of the newsreels that were shown of the Battle of the Somme, for example, and the Cambrai, the first big tank action of the First World War, was newsreel taken of that. And Sir Henry Robinson, the Vice President of the Local Government Board, one of the key figures in the government here, the British administration, actually said it makes great, it makes very entertaining newsreel, but I'm not sure it's sending the message that we want. So it was very much a double-edged sword. And the other thing we tend to forget is that crime changed in Ireland. I've been looking at some crime figures recently for Dublin. Crime changed, and one of the big groups of offenders, never there before in the top stakes, were British soldiers. When I say British soldiers, meant them were Irish men in British uniform. Mm. They were deserters. So desertion became a big problem, particularly in Dublin. And every deserter coming back was another propagandist, if you like, against the war. He was coming back saying, it's not very nice over there. I'm not going back, and I don't think anyone else should go. So that was all those processes were happening all the time and affecting people's lives and people's attitudes. So it's very easy to see why by 1918, when the British government said, we want more troops out of Ireland, why there wasn't any great enthusiasm for it.
Well, you can see, with the propaganda that they use in Britain to encourage people to recruit, it's really a lot of it plays up on, do you want to be a coward? All your friends are going. Why aren't you going? Daddy, what did you do during the war? But that's not really going to play as well in Ireland, because I remember looking at the forms that the RIC had to fill out during the conscription crisis, asking people would they be willing to go. It's just sheets and sheets of, like, under no circumstances, and 10 of you will have to come and drag me away. So you can see in England, or in Britain maybe, there's more of, like, you know, the women handing out the white feathers, the able-bodied men staying at home. That isn't really an issue in Ireland. The people who were really enthusiastic about volunteering would have been the people who went in those early years, or people for economic reasons who would have went. Even when you look back at Tom Barry's book, Guerrilla Days in Ireland, his reasons are, like, you know, I wanted adventure, I was a young man, I wanted to see the world. And other people who would become radicalised as the years went on, like Ernie O'Malley, he's part of that, like, educated, middle class, Catholic, university going. And those type of people and their friends would have been, it would have been very normal to be in officer training corps or see your friends in university signing up and getting an officer's uniform. But for people who were mainly going there for economic reasons, you know, it's soldiering is one career in peacetime, but in wartime, if you look at the conditions, they're comparing, you know, German and British trenches. Like, if you were in a trench in the middle of winter in France or Flanders, you're talking about rats, lice, poor hygiene, poor food, getting rained on. You know, it's unless you really have that patriotic zeal, it's hard to sell that life to people.
I think, in fact, it goes very deep right across Europe. You know, Scholar says that people were getting more and more disillusioned with the war. And it destabilized the whole continent, most obviously in Russia, but also in the other major combatant powers. I mean, Germany collapsed internally. Mm-hmm. In Ireland, actually, I think it was different. We were lucky in that we were semi-detached from the war. The war never came to us the way it did to the big continental countries. So we didn't see that. But in a way, that made our revolution, if you like, that bit more respectable, that bit more stable. We were reacting to an external shock. In other countries, there was massive alienation, including Britain. We shouldn't forget Red Clydeside from 1917 onwards. Massive engineering strikes right across Britain. Actually sending shop stewards to the front as troublemakers or sending them to prison. There was growing discontent right across Europe with the war. And after the war, I think, one of the reasons why Sinn Féin was so confident that they could take on the British Empire was you had demonstrations in British camps for demobilisation. Mm. Now, you had people trading bullets in Berlin and Petrograd, but even in London and on the south coast and the big army camps, a lot of unrest. Soldiers wanted to go home. The governments generally were discredited, and capitalism was also discredited. It was a very radical left-wing movement spreading across Europe at that time, which impacted on us far less than other people. And I think one of the reasons is the war just didn't get to us. Not in any way. We had the Easter Rising in Dublin for a week, but it didn't reach us in the way it did Russians or French or Germans or Poles or all the other nationalities.
I think, Cathal, we mentioned a little earlier the Ulster Volunteers in relation to how the landing of arms had proved an impetus and an encouragement for the volunteers in the south to do the same thing. What was the role of the Ulster volunteers? Because obviously a large number of them did travel to Europe. What was their role? Did they maintain a consistent role once they got to the continent? There are stories of groups of Ulster volunteers travelling to Europe and staying together in the same battalions and fighting together. Is there any sense of that they had a particular role once they got to
I think it's very interesting because we normally put the 36th Ulster Division and the 16th Irish Division together. There was also the 10th Division as well, which would have been the existing divisional area for Ireland when the war began. But I think that's probably one of the areas that, as the decade of commemoration goes on, partition is one that we really need to look at in relation to the First World War and how Ireland was different before the war and in the years after the war. I think the Ulster Division plays a huge role in the consciousness of unionists now in the North and throughout the history of Northern Ireland, because it was really viewed as Northern unionists showing their blood sacrifice in a way, like 1916 was in Dublin, for the link with the Union and the Empire. But when you look at the pre-war Ireland, the idea that Ulster was six counties would have been ridiculous. Ulster was nine counties. Edward Carson puts down an amendment that, you know, all of Ulster will be excluded. With the Ulster Volunteer Force, the 1912, 1913 Ulster Volunteer Force, and the Ulster Unionist Council, their idea is that all of Ulster will be excluded. You know, why leave Donegal in and not Fermanagh or somewhere else? Like, you know, and there was large Unionist populations in Cavan, Donegal and Monaghan, not to the same extent as east of the Ban, But when you look at, say, for example, Cyril Falls wrote a book, A History of the 36th Ulster Division, and the first couple of pages when you look in, they mentioned the different units of the UVF that were incorporated into the 36th Ulster Division, and it's like, you know, the Donegal unit, the Cavan unit, like Oliver Nugent, the Major General who becomes... who takes command of the 36th Ulster Division. He's one of the leaders of the UVF in Cavan. He's a Cavan man. So I think for unionists in Northern Ireland, Carson and Craig are the greatest unionist leaders ever, unless you're a unionist from Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. Like, you've signed an Ulster Covenant saying not one inch of Ulster will be ceded. They've sent their men over to the Somme to fight and die, and then a stroke of a pen, and suddenly all the promises are forgotten. So I think unionists prefer to forget that. You know, when they say Ulster now, they mean the six counties. So it's very interesting. And even if you look on things like YouTube, when they show like the Ulster Division, they'll show a map of Northern Ireland. They won't show a map of Ulster. So things like that, I think, will challenge, like there's been a lot of things with commemorating Republican events where people have been encouraged to challenge the narratives, challenge their understandings. I wonder, will we see similar among unionists and their understanding of the war and their understanding of a pre-war Ireland? Because Northern Ireland is only, what, 93 years old, 92 years old. It hasn't existed for time immemorial. And when we think back to Ireland pre-war, we're thinking back to one country within the United Kingdom, but a pre-partitioned Ireland.
Pádraig, when the war concluded and those Irishmen who had fought on the continent returned home, what was the reaction? What was the welcome, if any, that they received?
I think it depended where you're going home to. If you're going home to Dublin or Belfast, you were quite welcome in some circumstances. I mean, a friend of mine, His grandfather, was a sergeant major in the Connacht Rangers in the First World War. It didn't stop his neighbours from burning him out in 1920 because he was a Catholic. So it depended where you went. If he had been Protestant or he'd lived in a different area of Belfast, that wouldn't have happened. Other people went back to Tipperary and they had to leave again very quickly. Quite a lot of them, I think, rejoined the British Army. It's one of the unusual areas. Dublin, generally speaking, no one's made a detailed study of it, but 25,000 went away, 20,000 came back, 5,000 died. There's no indication that there was huge discrimination against them. On the other hand, it has to be said that the average unemployment rate amongst ex-servicemen in Ireland after the First World War was 46%. So it was way above the national average at that time. Mm. So that must be put down to a number of things. One is discrimination. Another is incapacity. A lot of these men went away, their employer said they'd take them back. But the small print said, if you're able to do the job, but if you've been gassed or you're suffering from TB or you're psychiatrically ill, you're not going to be in a fit condition to do the old job. And then you had rising unemployment. The man who was in the job would keep the job. And one of the underlying factors in the Belfast pogroms was the fact that a lot of Catholics had been employed when men had gone to the Ulster Division. These men were coming back and wanted their jobs back, and they couldn't get them back because other people were in them, and the demand for ships had fallen dramatically during the war, so there was less work to be had. So all of those factors play, but it depends very much, I think, on who you are and where you're going back to. I suppose the biggest single casualty group were the Anglo-Irish, who died in far greater numbers because of their military tradition than anywhere else. But the other thing, the other myth, you know, that we shouldn't forget is that it was the urban poor who fought the First World War in Ireland, partly because of conscription. If it had been conscription, it would have been much fairer levying of troops, if you like. But it was the urban poor, the people who didn't have an option, who by and large, wherever they were living, went. They're also the least educated, the least articulate people. So when they came back, if they had problems, they had more difficulty expressing them or getting a hearing. And I think the last nail in the coffin, ironically enough, was the British Legion, because there were umpteen ex-servicemen's groups set up in Ireland after the First World War, as were in Britain. But when Earl Haig came along and suggested that they don't go the route of Germany or Italy or these other countries and have all these highly politicised ex-servicemen's groups, and they agreed on the British Legion, it meant that they depoliticised it. They made it, if you like, a tame mothers and orphans, you know, charitable body, which was grand in Britain to some extent. It had its limitations there, but meant it meant they were effectively eliminated as any potential political force in Ireland.
I think it's fair to say, Cathal, that, and we're just running short of time, so maybe we'll just briefly mention it, but it's fair to say that the new Irish state was not keen to recognise those soldiers who had fought with the British Army. Has that situation changed up to the current time? Are those soldiers more recognised than they had been?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that process really began in the 90s. Mary Robinson attended a remembrance service, I think it was 93, and then you have the official reopening or opening of Island Bridge, I think, in 94. We've seen a lot of stuff is to do with the peace process, and I think there was the Fine Gael TD, Paddy Hart, was involved in memorial gardens in on First World War sites, and bringing together that idea of the orange and green with the 16th and the 36th division memorials. I think more so, yes, and especially, you know, as we get into the centenary, people are looking back at the experiences of ordinary soldiers, what motivated them. People are looking to trace back their family trees and look at what their grandfather or great-grandfather or uncle might have done during the war. I think there is a recognition now. I think there's so many complicated reasons over the 20th century why it was probably better for the state, or in their opinion, to ignore it and to prevent, you know, any falling out. You had things like banning Armistice Day marches and stuff like that. So it seems safer to completely ignore it and hope they'd go away. But I think we should definitely remember, because you really don't get an idea of the state we're living in now or how it came about without fully understanding what effect the war had on Ireland.
Now, we're just coming...
Could I just say, because members of my own family served in the British Army in the Second World War and some in the First World War. But, I mean, it is a very complex issue. But just to throw another thread in, if my dad is dead now, but for him being in the British Army was just a job. And he just happened to be in it during the Second World War. But he would no more think of getting any special mention for it than for being a welder or working in a particular factory. It was a job. He didn't expect to be excoriated for it, but he didn't expect to be patted on the back either. He just got on with his life. And I think for millions of ex-servicemen, that's what they did. It was something they had to get through. They survived. They're grateful to survive, and they wanted to get on with their lives. So I think there's a tendency for us to over-empathise and imagine things about the past, which may not actually be the way the people who lived through it felt at the time.
Okay, we're just coming to the end of the programme now for this week. I'm afraid I was going to make you nervous again, Cathal, by asking you nearly as big a question as the one I asked you at the start. I was going to ask you what lasting effects the Treaty of Versailles had. I think we could continue talking for another couple of hours, but perhaps we might be able to bring up the Treaty of Versailles next week when we'll be discussing Europe after World War II. Very briefly now, before we finish, and if I could challenge you to maybe say this in a couple of sentences, what lessons do you think modern Europe could learn from the First World War, Cathal?
I think probably it's been mentioned many times before, but two words, never again. It's just when you really look into the numbers of men who died and all for what, like Vietnam, America looks back quite a lot at Vietnam, 56,000 men killed. That's a couple of days on the Western Front in terms of casualties. It's just enormous. And then for to go through the same process then 20 years later, it would be hard to see how we could slip into the same type of thing again, but I suppose it must make us more aware of conflicts throughout the world when we look back at what happened in Europe 100 years ago, that we should do everything in our power to prevent the same things happening throughout the world today.
Mm-hmm. Porrick, lessons
for Again, people have to try and take ownership of their own futures. And it is, I think, very worrying that we have a political elite in Europe at the moment and nationally, but particularly at the European level, who seem to be drifting into similar situations and shows that, and Yugoslavia before it showed that nationalism is still a very potent force in Europe. And unless we develop a political elite who can do the job, and we don't have one at the moment, I wouldn't be at all optimistic about the future.
Okay, thank you very much. You've been listening to Europe on Air. I have been Alan Bradish, and I've been joined by Cathal Brennan and Parra Gates. Thank you very much for talking to us. Next week's topic is Europe after World War II. Europe on Air was produced and researched by Dorothy Meyer Holtkamp and Zandra Ball. And sound was by Yasmina Tawil. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week.
Thanks.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour programme looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday 4:30 to 5 p.m. Europe on Air radio campaign has been financed by the European Union. The contents of the radio shows reflect only the author's views, and the Commission is not responsible for any use that may be made of the information they contain.